Hey there, everyone. I hope wherever you are is comfy, cozy, and not too crazy. The holiday season is upon us, for those living in Western countries, so I hope you all have fun and safe plans to celebrate. This has been a crazy year, but I don't know if 2021 is necessarily going to be the full return to grace from 2020. So I thought I'd ask this week's guest, Amelia Kallman, for a vision into the future. What happened after that was a far more interesting delve into Amelia's past and how she ended up with her really unique job title. Hey Amelia, how are you today?
I'm doing good, thank you. Yeah, very good, thank you. How are you?
I'm good. I'm jet lagged. I think I need to get over the 6-hour time difference I just got back from.
Yeah. Well, hopefully you can sleep over the weekend.
Yeah, the problem isn't sleep. It's actually waking up. Amelia, do you mind if I ask a little bit about you to sort of set the stage for our conversation? I'm excited to dive into specifics, but, you know, where are you from? Where do you live? What do you do?
Yeah, sure. If you're listening, you might be able to tell I'm not originally from the UK, even though I live here now. I was born in Pittsburgh, but raised in Fairfax, Virginia, right outside Washington, D.C. And then I went to college in Manhattan, and then I moved to China for a while, and now I live in the UK, in London, where I am a futurist.
I don't think I've ever heard that job title before. So what does a futurist do? And I guess the extra question there is, what does the future look like?
You'll have to pay me for that answer, yeah. Yeah, so I study new technologies and their potential impact on the future of business and the future of our lives. I forecast trends and I work with companies. I kind of sit in a unique space because I'm a bit between startups and the people developing the technology and then corporate clients and governments who want to use and implement the technology. So I help consult and strategize. I help mitigate risk. I do a lot of research, a lot of communication around these technologies. And then I guess one thing I'm kind of particularly known for that makes me a bit unique is not just looking at the opportunities and potential of these technologies, but also the potential of the risk that is involved with these technologies. So things, for instance, like I do a lot of work with XR, virtual augmented mixed reality. I host the XR Summit every year. This next year, it's going to be in Barcelona in June. They've had to move it because of COVID and stuff. And things like looking at the impact of 5G and edge computing. So how that's going to change our relationship with technology due to that kind of increased speed and latency and quality, our relationship with data and what that means. Some of my favorite technologies are things like haptics, looking at, you know, mid-air virtual touch sensation and how we could use that to potentially stop spreading coronavirus. Because you think about things like ATMs or those little like buttons that you press when you walk across the street and how filthy those things must be, you know, and what if we didn't have to touch them anymore? Wouldn't that be a great thing? I hosted the World Summit AI this week. And looking at things like the future of robots and artificial intelligence, and then also being able to generally be real with people about where we're at today and where, you know, we're going in the future. I kind of love that. When I was working for agencies before, it was very much like market, sell, you know, and I kind of had a problem with that personally, because, you know, technology is not the answer to all our problems. Yeah, there's a lot to think about. So, and then when it comes to trends, kind of cultural and societal trends, you know, this kind of, we're in a moment where we're in a crisis of truth. You know, you can't believe what you see and hear. You know, there's deep fakes, there's fake news, there's all this kind of stuff. So how can we maybe use technology to help us regain a sense of truth? What that would look like, you know, activist consumerism, demand for regulation, and then the human rights issues of tomorrow. So
basically, that's everything cascading towards us in our pandemic.
Well, that said, you know, I mean, COVID really threw a wrench in the works. You know, we knew that something was going to happen at some point, but and then it happens and you're kind of like, okay, so yeah, it's been interesting. I think the CEO of Microsoft said recently that, you know, 2 years of digital transformation has happened in 2 months for most companies. So being able to navigate through this time is interesting. And it's really fast-forwarding our need for a lot of these tools and technologies that have been in development.
Yeah, I don't think we all knew exactly what... Well, I'd rather say that Zoom was not in the public sphere quite as much as it is now, for example, on all those apps that help you work remotely are really, really on top of their game more so. But I'm actually curious about you. So how did you end up in a job like this? I don't remember seeing futurist in a job description at a career fair.
Right? The thing is I was doing what a futurist does for a creative technology agency under the title of Global Head of Innovation. And I ran innovation labs in London and Dubai. I did all their forward research. I did consulting about, you know, future technologies, speaking, communication, all this kind of stuff. In 2017, the company downsized. I got laid off. And I had to kind of assess where I was at. And the truth was, is futurist was the title that most accurately defined what I do. So it was kind of just having the balls to call myself that and to move forward. And that's what I did.
So were you trained at all in like a technical sort of manner?
Yeah, I mean, not in a traditional sense. I went to college for acting. You know, if you had told me that I would be consulting with insurance companies about the risks of machine learning and, I don't know, virtual reality and these kind of things back then, I never would have believed you. But in some ways, you know, I think I've been prepared. The skills that I use are things that I've been using my whole life. And the reasons I'm good at my job are, you know, a combination of things. So like the skills and experience that I have acquired in previous jobs, you know, even though I didn't realize this is where I was kind of headed. What was really important as well was my timing coming into this industry. So I came in 2013, and that was a pivotal year. That was when Oculus Rift got kickstarted. That was when Google Glass came out. You know, IBM Watson was starting to be developed, all these kind of things. So I came in at a time when nobody was an expert on these things. They were all brand new. And because of the position I held, I was kind of at the forefront. I got to be hands-on with these technologies. It was my job to know all about them and where they were going and why these were important. And because I don't come from a traditional technology background, I think I have a real skill at being able to make the complex accessible to people and be able to communicate these potentials. And I really believe that technology is for the people. So it's here to enhance the human experience. And part of that is being able to understand it. And that became a really unique skill and talent for this industry. And then also there's my belief in hard work. I'm a very hard worker, especially when I feel passionate about something and I'm curious about something. And then also my belief in myself that I could do it, you know? So I think a combination of those have really helped me to get where I am today.
That's fascinating. There's like a fascinating experience that I've noticed in the technology industry. It's around people who weren't necessarily formally trained for their roles. And it's sometimes very gender specific to a lot of women in the technology industry, but it's this imposter syndrome. I'm not sure that I'm cut out for this, or maybe the industry isn't as warm to someone like me being in there. I know I suffer from it. Do you ever feel like you have some imposter syndrome?
Yeah, I kind of, thinking about this question, it really made me kind of go back to my childhood in a way, because when I was young and I was learning how to read, I had a really hard time learning how to read, basically. And I got diagnosed with a learning disability in audio processing. And what this meant to a six-year-old was that they used to pull me out of class and I'd have to go to the special class or something. So I kind of felt like I wasn't as smart as the other kids, or there was something that was a bit different about me. And then when I was 8, I got moved into the Gifted and Talented program, which is a terrible name to call a program for school, you know, like, I mean, but it meant that I got thrown in with all these really smart kids, and I always thought I was the underdog. And so my instinct has always been that I need to work twice as hard to prove that this is where I should be and that I need to be there. And I think having that, I just adapted and became comfortable knowing that I was going to have to work really hard and really extra. Especially when I started as a futurist on my own, I would get especially nervous when I had to go on and do talks, especially panels when maybe the questions weren't prearranged and things. And it was actually, you know, in 2017, which I mentioned was a big year because that's when I left kind of working for other people and went on freelance and worked for myself. But I worked with somebody who really kind of changed my perspective on this. And she said to me, you know, you have knowledge that will help other people. And it's a kindness to share that. And it really kind of took the ego out of it and made me realize that I do have knowledge and I do have a lot to give. And that really helped me to become more confident, just kind of changing that perspective. Because every time I go into this stuff, I always think, oh my gosh, do I know enough? And I'd prepare like crazy. And then I go in and I do this thing and I realize, does anybody else in this room like know what I'm talking about? I don't know. So yeah, it is tough. And especially this year has been a bit tough because basically it's like a muscle, you know, and it's a muscle that we exercise all the time. So the first 3 months of this year, I was doing 2 presentations a week. I was writing reports. I was like, you know, doing so much that it was like, yeah, I know what I'm talking about. Like, you know, I'm on the edge of my game and I'm like all over it. And then things like COVID happened and all of a sudden, you know, like I went a month this year without having work. And it was like, whoa. Am I still good at this? Do I still know what I'm doing? And then kind of coming back into it, finding that confidence again. Yeah, I think it's natural to kind of deal with that.
Yeah, I mean, you're a female in tech, and I would say this industry has a really weird spotlight on it, especially in the male-dominated, minorly sexist side of things. I lived in California for a while. That was definitely a big issue at the time. Do you think it's a fair portrayal at the moment, or maybe has it gotten it better, or do we have a ways to go still?
I think there's still a ways to go, but I can see it changing. It needs to, because basically we're not going to get to be sustainable. We're not going to be where we need to be without diversity, without these voices represented. There are big movements within the community, within the industry to make it more fair, to make it more diverse. And I really believe that we have the potential to be leaders, to be able to say, you know, look, we have been able to do this in the technology industry. Especially starting out, it was very difficult for me and I think a lot of women. Oh, I got some stories. I'm not even going to go into them, but I got some stories. And I think any woman in this industry probably does. But what that means is that people aren't giving up. They're coming back and we're supporting each other as women. You know, anytime I can give, I mentioned before, I host the XR Summit. And it's really important to me to make sure that we have diversity, make sure we have 50-50 representation, all these things. And that's part of the reason I think they brought me in. The first year, I don't think they had that represented at all. But now when I look at the things I get brought in to speak at, those are things and issues I can raise as an activist, as a person, say, you know, I will participate in this. I want to make sure that this is the kind of event I am participating in, that it's equally represented. So, yeah, I mean, we all have a role to play in that. And it's just about speaking up and not being afraid to be heard.
I find that the general trend is getting a bit better. Depends where you are a little bit. I mean, we live in the UK, but I spent a bunch of time in California. Obviously, very hot button issue there. And for a lot of people, it feel like it's slowly progressing in the way that they hope it's better. But that 50-50 number isn't quite there yet. I remember seeing a number at the Heathrow Airport that 46.5% of all the trains running in London were run by women. And, you know, it's not 50-50. It's going to take that little extra effort, but it's a move in the right direction. Did you ever do this futurist job anywhere else? Have you done it only in the UK? How did you end up in the UK, given that you're an American? Would you move here to be a futurist?
All right. Okay. No, in a short answer. So I moved here from China because I got thrown out of China.
Wait, what?
Yeah, so I in 2007 I left New York City, moved to Shanghai. 2 years later, I opened up the very first burlesque and cabaret nightclub in China. It was amazing. We had a 1933 Buddhist temple that we transformed into the most gorgeous 30s cabaret nightclub, and just were living the dream. Really, I had We had a different show every week. I directed the show. I was one of the showgirls. We had an international chorus line of singers and dancers. And it was like, we called it New Vaudeville Entertainment. So it was pre-television. And it was really amazing. We did two nights a week in Chinese, two nights in English. And we became very successful and very popular. And that became a problem for us as foreigners. And things escalated. And I ended up getting thrown out of China. I had to leave in 36 hours or else risk going to prison for 10 years. And they froze our bank accounts. We lost everything. And my husband's British. So we basically just said, okay, where should we go? We went to Bali thinking it was all going to blow over because we had lawyers and this and that, but it didn't. And basically, I can't go back to China in a nutshell. So yeah, so ended up here in London. It took me 2 years to get a visa to work. They rejected me, which was absolutely mind-blowing that I was married to a Brit and they rejected me. They sent me back to America for 2 months. I had to pay all this money when I had none. Oh, it was an awful, awful time. But yeah, then I got my visa and then I needed a job, any job. And that's when I went to an innovation conference and I hosted my friend's booth because I said, you know, I'm good at talking to people and I'll host your booth. And there was a booth a couple over from ours and they had all this really cool technology. They had touchscreen tables and virtual books and augmented reality. And I just kept going over and asking questions like, what is this? How does this work? You know? And then I was bringing my people over and explaining to them what had been explained to me. And somebody said to me, do you work for us? And I said, no, but I should. And a week later, I started there as a marketing assistant. And that's the company that I worked my way up to become their global head of innovation. I should mention that whole Chinese story. It's in my book, Diary of a Shanghai Showgirl, which is it's won a couple of awards. It's a bestseller. Check it out. It might be made into a TV series. So, yeah.
That was like a very action-packed answer to the question that I had posed. I appreciate it, though. I have a couple questions. First of all, just for people who might not understand, why would China have wanted to kick you out?
Oh, you got to read the book, mate.
Okay, perfect. I'll link the book for people who want to read it. And I don't want to go too deep into that story because it's obviously written down somewhere. But I am curious, because you said you're in New York before China. Were you doing the same thing there? Were you doing like cabaret burlesque kind of shows in New York?
So I grew up as a child actress. And then I went to college for acting in New York. And I had just gotten back from studying Shakespeare at Oxford University when I crashed a party on the rooftop of the Chelsea Hotel. And this guy was going around, he was tapping everybody on the shoulder and he'd say, hi, do you know me? And if they said no, he'd say, well, get the hell off my roof. And came around to me, tapped me on the shoulder, and I was embarrassed. I was waiting for him to kick me out. And instead, he told me I was beautiful. And he asked if he could kiss me, and I said okay. And that's the man who I'm married to today. So he was a nightclub designer in New York, and he lived in the penthouse of the Chelsea Hotel. And he introduced me to this whole kind of new lifestyle, I guess. I don't know. I'd never heard of burlesque before, but he owned these burlesque nightclubs, and he was really, you know, at the forefront of the neo-burlesque movement. And then, you know, he was going to do a show. He got asked to design a club and was going to put a stage in and do a show. And I wanted to be involved because I didn't want my boyfriend hanging out with all these beautiful half-naked women without, you know, me being there. I needed to be there. So he said, come up with an act and I'll put you on my show. So I came up with this idea to perform any movie in 3 minutes as a showgirl. So I pick a movie out of a hat and I perform any movie in 3 minutes. And then we got an offer after doing a series of shows in one of his nightclubs to open up an illegal speakeasy. So I had an actual illegal speakeasy on 26th Street between Broadway and 6th Avenue. It was on the 10th floor of an office building, password only. You know, it was before Facebook or anything like that. So you really had to know somebody to get in. And we only held about 75, 80 people. And we sold flasks and bottles of champagne. And you could smoke, but you couldn't smoke cigarettes. And we had, you know, a chorus line of showgirls. And just, I mean, the best performers in New York City on this little gorgeous stage. And one of my favorite memories from that is the night that Bjork asked me for my autograph. Pretty incredible. I was like, sorry, how do you spell that? You know?
Wow, that's amazing. So you've got a trajectory that's really impressive. And I guess your life did start with a very artistic orientation. My blanket statement here would probably be, oh, well, you're not doing anything super artistic right now. And I realize that might be incorrect, given that you have this foundation to your life. So can I ask then, what are you doing to fill that creative desire and to scratch that itch right now?
Yeah, so I have two things that I do. So my biggest outlet, the thing that relaxes me the most at the moment, is making collages. So I've had two exhibitions in London of my work. I had one in Shanghai, and it really uses a completely different part of my brain. So I mentioned I hosted that summit on Wednesday. That was all about AI. And the next day, just to kind of decompress from that, I'm literally cutting and pasting and putting things together and making art. And that's something that just really kind of, I feel like I channel it. It just kind of flows through me. And I have a really special relationship with it. And it's not something I do for commerce at all, though I do sell my pieces. But yeah, it's just, that's really cool. And then the other thing is I'm working on my second book right now. So that is a novel. It had started out as a memoir. I've done this book completely ass backwards. I don't recommend my strategy on how to do it at all, but I'm getting there. It's getting there. So it's fiction. It's called The Last Chelsea Girl. There's elements that are loosely based on my time living at the Chelsea Hotel, but it also includes a lot of the famous characters who live there. So people like Patti Smith and Leonard Cohen and Nancy Spungen and Janis Joplin. Yeah, so that's been quite fun. So that has, especially during lockdown, you know, that's basically, I've gave myself this virtual world to get lost into where, you know, I get to play God. It's difficult writing a book, though, I gotta say. It's not easy.
I'd actually like your advice for something here, because there are a lot of people who are going to try a lot of new things in the next couple of years, given that we've flipped the world upside down with this pandemic. And you seem like someone who's actively jumped into various disciplines, feet first, like you really dove deep. You know, you were never really trained to be a showrunner, for example. You weren't trained to be a futurist. I'm assuming you didn't learn Chinese before you went there. You might have learned it there. What do you say to people who've asked, you know, how do I get into this? You know, Amelia, you've gotten into 5,700 new things at professional level. How does one like me even assess trying to learn or write a book or whatever it is that you seem to be doing so easily?
Yeah. So, I mean, I honestly believe that if you have the desire to do something and you're moved to, like, go for it, absolutely do it. The only thing that can hold you back is yourself. You know, I have to work against myself. It's a good thing to remember that you're your biggest critic. And if you do want to go do something, like, there is nothing stopping you, go for it. I think for me, a big part of me getting into being a futurist in my industry and stuff is getting into that community. So I feel like I have a good community in this industry now, and it has grown. But when I started, you know, it was obviously much smaller, but people are really such an asset, and having the right people in your circle who maybe believe in you, who you can talk to and ask for advice, even if it's just one person you know who's done it before, that person can become an advocate for you or can give you some advice and can help you. You know, we live in an amazing time too, because there's so much at our fingertips. You know, there's so much that we can look into over the internet and stuff, but don't underestimate the power of relationships and people. And people, you know, they love to give advice. They love to help. I do a lot of work as a mentor with kind of next generation. And that's something that I'm a lot more passionate about than, well, it's a new kind of thing that I'm interested in and how I can help other people. Yeah, I would recommend asking lots of questions, being curious, you know, going to every kind of event that you can go to kind of learn more, network, even though networking is awkward and you're putting yourself out there. It's really part of almost anything you do. I consider myself a shy person. You know, I grew up and I was, part of the reason I fell into acting was because I was so shy. I felt like if I could pretend to be another character or act like I wasn't shy, then I could really find out how I could navigate. But I think that ability to communicate, to not be afraid to put myself out there, to make a mistake, to ask questions, has really served me in the long run.
Do you feel like you have some level of confidence that's particularly helpful here? Like you learned a bunch of information at a booth and then you walked up and explained it to other people. And then somebody asked you if you worked there and you said, not yet, but I should. I mean, that's a certainty that most of us don't have. So do you think that characteristic has helped you a lot in the endeavors of your life?
Yeah, absolutely. I also, this is a funny piece of advice, but it is something I'd probably recommend. I mean, and I have it because I came at it from an acting point of view. And one of the things I talked about in my book was, you know, I had this character, Miss Amelia, and she wasn't afraid of anything. She was like that fabulous, sexy showgirl on stage who could talk to anybody and could tell jokes and could do all this kind of stuff. And it wasn't necessarily, you know, who I was at home, you know, or with my husband or something, but being able to kind of tap into that character. And if you are shy, if you're not sure that you want to put yourself out there, if you imagine kind of who that person might be, or you look at one of your friends or somebody in your circle or your family, like who's the person that can go out and have that conversation? And then just like kind of practice, like try it on, like a costume, like what that might feel like to go out and put yourself out and say those things. And then again, it's like a muscle. The more you kind of try it, the more you do it, the more you realize it's okay. And also just remember, like, what's the worst that can happen? Honestly, we kind of like build these things up in our heads that, you know, oh, like, you know, if somebody turns me down or they don't like me or something, that's going to be terrible. But honestly, like, you know, okay, thanks, next. It's really not that bad at the end of the day. And that's one of the things that when I go on stage speaking, that was a piece of advice too about, so I don't get so nervous anymore, but because somebody finally said to me, it was the worst thing that could happen. You know, people start throwing tomatoes or, you know, but okay, so imagine what that's like. Is that really as bad as it could be? Like, could you still, you know, go home and come back and do another, you know, speaking engagement next week, you know? And it's like, all right, just getting that kind of perspective in mind has helped as well.
Last couple questions here. I'm just looking at the things you've told me about your life and what you do right now, your creative endeavors and your professional life. I feel like you're someone who has a lot going on at any point in time. Like your plate's almost always full. It's a bit like that shark analogy that a shark is always meant to be moving to stay alive. So my question is a bit of a challenge on that, which is, what do you do to quiet down? Can you quiet down? What is Amelia's calm look like?
I'm not a workaholic. Like, I think I have a good, I manage that well, this kind of work-life balance. So for instance, after that AI conference, I needed to watch like some mindless TV. I watched the documentary on Amazon Prime about Lorena Bobbitt, and I found out it took place right down the street from where I grew up, and it like blew my mind. I'm still watching the documentary series. I'm definitely a big fan of watching mindless TV and Box series and that kind of things to like help decompress. And I do my collage work. Like, that's very quiet work for me.
Yeah, I asked that question out of selfishness because I'm one of those stir crazy, always moving type people. My friends have oftentimes asked me, like, do you ever just stop? And I feel like I always need something to do. But, you know, last thing for you, and I guess this is a weird combination of questions from our conversation, what's next? Like, you're a futurist in technology. What's coming up in our world is how you make your living and how we're interacting. But what is in Amelia's future?
I would love to get back to traveling because that's one of my favorite parts about my job. So I'm hoping that 2021, we can go back to that kind of in-person communication again, you know. And I think it's been interesting this year because I talked a bit about this kind of like cyclical nature, you know, and it's been almost like an enforced low that we've all had. Like, we've had to kind of sit home, hold tight, reassess, you know, look at things differently. And I do believe that, you know, while economically and things, we're going to be feeling the effect of this for a while, there will be an upswing that comes from this. And there will be innovations, there will be opportunities, there will be people who have had this time to assess, who've decided that they're going to change their lives and do things differently. I mean, for me, you know, my priorities have definitely changed as I've gotten older. I very much prioritize my time with my husband, my time with my family, my time with my friends, and also the time that I have to do these creative projects that I do. And then I guess what's really become more important to me in the last year or so is how I can use my voice and my platform and what I do to make a difference. I kind of see myself leading a bit down that path. My husband wants me to go into politics, but I don't have the stomach for it. You know, you don't have to go into politics to make a difference. You can still make a difference with what you do and who you are and your voice and setting an example and being a leader. So yeah, so that's I think where I want to focus in the future.
That was Amelia Kallman, a futurist, and her wildlife story. Amelia's book is available to purchase, and I've linked it in the show notes. I wanted to thank her again for indulging me in a fairly fun and interesting conversation. She's talked about it abundantly elsewhere, so whilst it was a wild ride for me, it's old hat for her. You can find out more about her from the website that I've also linked in the show notes. Given that it's nearly Christmas, please take care of yourself and others over the holiday season. I'll be off for a few weeks and doing my best to unplug and prepare mentally for 2021. We'll be back to new episodes in January, so with that, I hope you all have a happy end of 2020, and here's to the future. That's it for today's story. If you liked what you heard and want to hear more, you can subscribe to get the latest updates anywhere you get your podcasts. And if you have a moment and you're feeling generous, please leave a review. I'd really appreciate it, and it helps me understand how to make this show even better. For more info on me and this concept, you can visit our website at onesimplequestion.co. One Simple Question is hosted by me, Abhishek Lahoti. Thank you so much for listening. I hope you tune in again soon, and bye for now.